This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Well, we are in day 11 of the government shutdown, and Congress needs all the help it can get from wherever it can get it. Later this hour, we'll hear from Senate Chaplain Barry Black. He delivers the morning prayer on the Senate floor, and he ministers to Capitol Hill. And he'll talk to us about why his experience has led him to tell senators enough is enough in Washington. And then to a man who knows a thing or two about getting saved, Captain Shane Murphy will be with us. He took over as master of the Maersk Alabama after Captain Richard Phillips was captured by Somali pirates in 2009. It's the true story behind this weekend's big release, Captain Phillips. Plus, a surprise announcement by the Norwegian Nobel Committee, which awarded the 2013 Nobel Peace Prize to the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons. More on that in just a few minutes. But first, there might now be some light at the end of the tunnel in Washington. House Republicans brought forward a plan yesterday that would offer a six-week extension on the nation's borrowing authority. That's the debt limit. The White House did not endorse that offer because it said nothing about the other part of this crisis, reopening the federal government. But now the two sides say they are in productive talks. That's a thaw. And Republicans say they may now be switching tactics, calling for a commitment from the president to negotiate on a bigger deal, on long-term deficit reduction, entitlements, and taxes. That would include an overhaul of the tax code. No mention, you'll notice, of the Affordable Care Act in that plan, at least not from House Republicans. Well, Congress has until next week to act before the U.S. Treasury will reach that borrowing limit. Joining us now to weigh in on the federal debt crisis is Mark Patterson, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. He's also former chief of staff at the Treasury Department from 2009 until May of this year. Mark, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, House Republicans and Democrats and Senate Republicans are now dipping in and out of the White House meeting with President Obama. That's a good sign. What's your take on where we stand right now? I mean, John Boehner is offering a six-week lifting of the debt limit. That's not very long to people in your world.
Yeah, only in Washington is a kick the can down the road for 6 weeks strategy deemed to be progress, but that's where we are. I do think it's a somewhat hopeful sign, though, because it appears as though the House has come around to the idea that they cannot attach very controversial policy riders to the debt ceiling increase, and that's a good thing.
So you think that that principle is being established here, except that Republicans still say they want the next debt limit increase to be contingent on some big negotiations that so far have failed over entitlements and spending and maybe even taxes?
Yeah, but I think the reason that they have taken the position they took yesterday is because they realized that they are not playing a winning hand, either substantively or politically, and the threat of default has not been successful in allowing them to extract any policy concessions from the president.
Well, Mark Patterson, one of the sort of background issues in this entire debt limit fight has been sort of the argument, the what if, what it really means to breach the debt limit. The country has sort of gotten a primer in the debt limit. And there are a lot of voices in Congress who say, you know, it's not as bad as everyone says. The president is fear-mongering over this. I want to play a clip from your former boss, Jack Lew, the Treasury Secretary. He was on Capitol Hill just yesterday in front of the Senate Finance Committee. Listen.
How can the United States choose whether to send Social Security checks to seniors or pay benefits to veterans? How can the United States choose whether to provide children with food assistance or meet our obligations to Medicare providers?
Mark Patterson, I had a United States senator tell me recently that those kinds of statements from the president were holding the country and seniors and veterans hostage. What do you think?
That's really not the case. Secretary Lew is exactly right. The kinds of choices that would be forced on the president and the Treasury Department in the event the debt ceiling is not raised would be completely untenable. The government just would not have the resources to pay all the obligations that it's legally required to pay. And that's a completely unacceptable situation. So the so-called default deniers are really doing a disservice when they're trying to tell the public that somehow or other the government could manage through a situation like that. You know, look, the United States government has always paid every bill in full and on time throughout our history. And that is what, in significant part, contributes to the confidence that investors here and around the world have in the United States. It's a source of economic strength for us. You know, it's funny. You have to look back at how we developed our financial institutions in this country early on. There's a reason that banks are built to look like neoclassical buildings, and there's a reason that the Treasury Department looks like a huge neoclassical fortress. It is to convey a sense of stability and confidence to the world. And we have established that trust with people all around the world, our own citizens, our own investors around the world. And we'd be totally foolish to give that up by stopping or delaying bills that we are really obligated to pay as a country.
One of the ways that your former boss, Jack Lew, has been dealing with the current debt limit standoff is to use prioritization or extraordinary measures. Basically, the Treasury uses reserve funds and can shift things around. In fact, the statutory debt limit was breached months ago. But one thing that's interesting about the latest Republican offer, Mark Patterson, is that if the six-week extension of the debt limit were to expire, say, November 22nd, it would specifically forbid those kinds of extraordinary measures. What would be the consequence of that?
Well, there's a couple of different ways you could look at that, and we're really into the arcana here, I guess. But the extraordinary measures are a tool that the Treasury Department uses if Congress hasn't raised the debt limit by the deadline when the debt limit is actually reached. And so on the one hand, they are helpful to the Treasury to make sure that the bills keep getting paid. On the other hand, it has become so routine to pass the debt limit and force the Treasury to use the extraordinary measures that they've actually become ordinary.
And at this point, Speaker Boehner and the House Republicans are saying they're going to be prohibited entirely if that deal goes through. What would that mean for Jack Lew?
Well, it would mean that the Congress would really have to raise the debt ceiling by the deadline date. They would no longer be able to violate it by weeks or months as they typically have done before. So that would just increase the pressure really on Congress to make sure that it executes its constitutional duty on time.
Well, I wanted to ask you again about this six-week extension and certainty. I mean, you mentioned certainty and even how it's conveyed in the architecture down at the Treasury mm-hmm. Department. If the only way out of this now is a temporary debt limit increase, 6 weeks or something on that order, does that convey any stability to the markets? Are people who deal in bonds and interest rates, which is in fact the entire U.S. economy, going to derive any sense of stability or certainty from a six-week increase?
I think there will be a brief sigh of relief on the part of the global financial system, but the overhang and that threat of default will still be there. And obviously, the six-week period will go by quickly. It's going to be run up against a holiday. And so I think it's really just a procrastination tool. Congress does love to put off its duties until the very last minute. But I think obviously it would be much healthier for the economy, for the country, if a longer-term solution should be reached. We actually ought to have a permanent solution to the debt limit. The debt limit statute is of no use because Congress has to raise it whenever the bills they pass total up to an amount that exceeds the debt limit. They have no choice really but to raise it. So it doesn't serve any purpose. It's sort of a vestigial organ. And it ought to be either repealed or Congress should find a way to delegate that authority to the executive branch in a way where they still conduct oversight of it, but they don't risk through their own inaction causing a default crisis.
Mark Patterson, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, former chief of staff at the Treasury Department from 2009 until May. Mark Patterson, thank you.
Thanks.
On now to the Nobel Peace Prize, and a lot of surprises this morning for a lot of people. Anyway, the Norwegian Nobel Prize Committee has awarded the 2013 Peace Prize to the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, otherwise known as the OPCW. The UN-backed body is currently seeking to destroy Syria's chemical weapons cache following the devastating chemical attacks on the Syrian people there in August. Michael Lujan is spokesperson for the OPCW. He was on this show earlier this month talking about the incredibly difficult task at hand for the organization.
Just the environment itself, the 35 to 40 degree daytime temperatures when our inspectors are going to be out visiting these sites. You know, they have to wear chemical protection gear. On top of that, they're going to have to wear flak jackets and helmets. It's going to be absolutely brutal. And, of course, there's the security dimension. This is really terra incognita for this organization.
Joining us now to weigh in on the Nobel Peace Prize decision is David Kaye, a senior fellow at the Potomac Institute for Policy Studies, who headed the Iraq Survey Group and led the American team searching for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq after the 2003 U.S. invasion. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Todd.
First, your reaction to the awarding of the Nobel Peace Prize to the OPCW.
Well, it was one of great surprise. I guess I bought in, like a lot of people, to the prevailing view that the favorite was Malala. I also a little surprised because it seems more an aspirational award about what the OPCW should do, might do, rather than for past accomplishments.
So you think they haven't earned it yet?
Unlike the prize in chemistry, physics, or literature, it's a little bit hard to see how you earn the Peace Prize based on past awards, but I wouldn't put them at the top of my list if I were ranking favorites for it.
If it wasn't the Organization for Prohibition of Chemical Weapons on your mind, David Kaye, who was it?
Well, quite frankly, it was Malala. I thought the young woman had shown tremendous courage. She spoke to aspirational goals that I think are important across the Mideast and Pakistan. The right of women, the right of girls to education, all things that I think, in fact, are keys to peace.
Does the OPCW's role in Syria, it seemed like when a deal was struck between Russia and the United States to get rid of the chemical weapons stockpile there, that this organization, this UN organization, were really the only people to be able to do it. Is that your sense as well, or could somebody else have done it?
I think it was the favored game. It would have been hard to avoid them. I actually think a UN-organized task force, such as we had in Iraq in 1991, which eliminated Iraq's chemical weapons, could have also done it. I don't think it was the only choice. It was clearly an obvious choice, though, and I think there's nothing wrong with that. In fact, I wish them the very best for what they're doing. My quibble is less about what they're doing and not at all about what they're doing. It's really about what was the basis for awarding them a prize for something yet to be accomplished.
You know, a lot of people asked that very same question in 2009, David Kaye, when our own President Barack Obama was awarded the Peace Prize. A lot of people said, for what?
Well, you're quite right. And in fact, a cynic would say that OPCW was awarded it because they helped avoid a previous winner of the prize unilaterally taking military action, which would have been some embarrassment to the Peace Prize.
And a couple of people have mentioned that maybe Vladimir Putin deserves the prize for the very same reason. David Kaye headed the Iraq Survey Group and led the American team searching for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq after 2003 and the invasion there. He is currently a senior fellow at the Potomac Institute for Policy Studies. David, thank you so much.
Thank you, Todd.
Well, as the OPCW continues its work in Syria to rid the regime of their chemical weapons stockpile, there's a new report released today by Human Rights Watch, and it accuses rebel groups in Syria of committing war crimes and possibly crimes against humanity there. The report looks at an attack against a pro-regime village on August 4th by rebel forces and concludes that at least 190 civilians were killed. More than 200 civilians are still being held hostage. The attacks on unarmed civilians were systematic against more than a dozen villages in the coastal area of Latakia. For an update now on the situation in Syria, we're joined by Lara Satrakian, founder of Syria Deeply and frequent guest on the show. Hi, Lara.
Great to be with you.
Your reaction, please, to the Human Rights Watch report that I just described, accusing rebel forces of atrocities and 190 civilians killed.
I think the scale of the attack is shocking, but not terribly surprising in the sense that we've seen an escalation in sectarian attacks on both sides of this conflict. Human Rights Watch says this is the first evidence of crimes against humanity by opposition forces, but they're very clear on which rebel forces they believe were behind it, specifically al-Qaeda-linked groups like Jabhat al-Nusra and Ahrar al-Sham. These are the more extremist groups on the ground. And these are groups that had seen systematic attacks on Sunni areas of Syria and vowed to take their revenge. Come August 4th, according to the Human Rights Watch report, they did just that. And of the 190 civilians that were killed, at least 57 of them were women and 18 were children. So a picture in this report of a very heinous crime against civilians in Alawite areas, really driving this fear among the various religious groups in Syria that there's really no way to avoid this cycle of revenge killings.
So there was no indication in the report, or was there, that these revenge killings were a reaction to the chemical attacks that that were exacted by the government forces on rebel towns?
This attack was just before the August 21st attack on Eastern Ghouta that we've heard so much about. But over the course of the conflict, Todd, there have been repeated instances of chemical weapons use believed to be perpetrated by the regime on rebel areas. So they're really, you look at the chemical weapons attacks and they really fall in the context of the broader violence against civilians that had been to date, according to the Human Rights Watch and others, disproportionately really violence by the regime against rebels and civilians in rebel-held areas. And now you're seeing this reaction from the extremist side of the rebel camp to that entire morass of violent incidents.
One of the issues here, Lara Satrakian, is accountability from the chemical attacks that came from government forces. There's a lot to be said about the compromise deal that was struck between Syria, the United States, and Russia. But Bashar al-Assad does appear to be losing his chemical weapons arsenal. In this case, these factions of the rebel forces, the al-Qaeda or Islamist factions, I'm not sure what the mechanism for accountability is aside from a Human Rights Watch report.
Well, you're touching on a critical point. The breakdown of accountability in Syria has palpable consequences, and this is one of them. The fact that rebels feel that there's no accountability, there are no consequences for the regime when it takes on heinous crimes, leads them to believe they need to take on their own heinous crimes. And when you think of accountability, justice, transitional justice, they all seem very far away from the situation on the ground at the moment. There really is no rule of law in the northern parts of Syria, certainly in those pockets that are now under rebel control. And you do see these groups really setting up their own system and their own rules for how they choose to engage. And it goes far beyond any conceptions of Geneva Conventions or trying to train moderate rebels to do things a certain way. That's completely out of the picture when you're talking about this kind of combat.
Well, part of accountability also, of course, is the dismantling of the chemical weapons arsenal on the government side, which we've been talking about. And the OPCW, the Organization for Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, has been awarded the 2013 Nobel Peace Prize. It's a good chance to get an update. How are they doing in their job, which is to actually physically dismantle that arsenal and prevent it from ever being used again? How are they doing?
Well, to their credit, and to speaking to the fact that they won the Nobel Peace Prize, they already have inspectors on the ground putting themselves in the line of fire. They've completed visits to at least 3 sites already. They plan to visit 20 chemical weapons sites around the country. There are possibly double that. So there's an open question of how they're going to reach all of these places where we believe that chemical weapons are being stored. They're taking on the work. It's very, very complex. It's very dangerous. We've seen live fire around some of the sites that they plan to visit in the past 24 hours. You know the war rages on. It's not going to stop at this point for the sake of making it easy for the OPCW. And that's, I think, really what that Nobel Peace Prize is recognizing, the fact that they've taken this step. They're one of the rare international organizations that's actually putting people on the ground to try to do something about this fight. And so far, from the limited time we've had to date, they're being credited with making substantial progress. And even the Assad regime is being credited with allowing them in and allowing them to do their work with what seems to be some degree of government compliance.
There's a new Human Rights Watch report detailing the massacre of at least 190 people by rebel forces from back in August in Syria. Lara Satrakian is founder of the blog Syria Deeply, who gave us an update on that report and also on the progress of the OPCW, which has been awarded the 2013 Nobel Peace Prize. Lara, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Well, all this hour, we're asking you who you would nominate for this year's Nobel Peace Prize. Sue in South Carolina has a suggestion.
Pope Francis, as he has reached out to the Catholics that lapsed from the church and to other people that seemed lost.
A listener in Austin, Texas writes, Lula, former Brazilian president, for his crusade against hunger in the world and removing 40 million Brazilians from extreme poverty. A listener in Atlanta, Georgia writes, NAACP because of efforts to stop gun violence and that they peaceably protested Trayvon Martin's death. And on Facebook, Dana writes to us, either Chelsea Manning or Edward Snowden, because they both put everything they had on the line to expose the vile, intrusive practices of our government. Send us your nominations for the Peace Prize. You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/thetakeaway.
Dad, are any of these movies good?
Worst episode ever.
I see a lot of films. I love all of them.
Your job is to rate movies on a scale from good to excellent.
Hated it.
Well, you can try, if you want to discern the heroes from the villains in the bloody drama that is Capitol Hill, or you can do it in a way that's a lot more fun. How about at the movies? As always, our movie date team, Rafer Guzman and Kristen Meinzer, here to weigh in on the actual movies that are coming up this week. Rafer, of course, film critic for Newsday. Kristen is our culture producer here at The Takeaway. Hi, guys.
Hi, Todd.
Hey, Todd.
Of course, you can always subscribe to the Movie Date podcast. And Kristen, you've got a special Movie Date podcast this week.
Yeah, we have Captain Phillips, the real Captain Phillips, an interview with him. Listen to the podcast to hear everything he has to say about the accuracies, inaccuracies of the movie, and about that accent of Tom Hanks's.
Okay, the actual real Captain Richard Phillips, not the Tom Hanks version. But, of course, you know that we're about to talk about the Tom Hanks version of Captain Phillips. Listen.
This is Mask, Alabama. We have two skiffs approaching at a distance of 1.5 miles with a possible mothership following.
Potential piracy situation.
Coffee, Alabama, you should alert your crew. Get your fire hoses ready and follow lockdown procedures.
Is that it?
I'm relaying your transmission now, but chances are it's just fishermen.
Then I'll hear the fish.
This is, of course, based on the real-life attack on the Maersk, Alabama in 2009 by Somali pirates. We all remember the story. Kristen, how does it transfer to the big screen?
I have to say it's incredibly tense. It's very engaging. I was on the edge of my seat the whole time. Although I do have to say I wish that there was a little bit more nuance to how the Somali pirates were depicted. They seem more like villains than humans. And Captain Phillips is depicted as a hero.
Rafer, any breakthrough performances from people playing Somali pirates or people we've never seen on the screen before?
Yeah, I do think, the pirates are all Somali Americans from Minnesota, I believe. They did a casting call and rounded them all up. And the
That's interesting.
Yeah, the lead actor whose name I think is Abdi...
Barkhad Abdi.
Thank you, Kristen. He plays Musay, who is the pirate captain. I think he's great, and I think he and the other Somali pirates are basically what make this movie so interesting. You really come to... you don't defend what they're doing, clearly, but you come to understand how desperate they are, what drove them to this, and that these aren't political zealots, these aren't terrorists, these are just subsistence-level fishermen driven to these extremes. And I think they really add a layer of humanity to the movie that it wouldn't have otherwise had, I think.
All right. Now, you guys also saw Machete Kills, the new Mexploitation film by Robert Rodriguez, starring Danny Trejo. Listen.
I like this.
Like your style. Low tech, but this ain't your mama's canker. Consider this the Swiss Army knife of machetes.
Rafer, Machete has lots of blood flying out of jugular veins. I just know it.
Oh yes. These are my people. Machete playing the world's meanest vato. He's back from the original film. Yeah, more bloodletting. More gunplay. Bodies flying apart. I thought this was a little stickier, a little cornier than the first one, but eventually it got me. It won me over. Really good performance, by the way, from Mel Gibson as the villain, an international arms dealer. I enjoyed it.
The villain. What a stretch for Mel Gibson.
Yeah,
Kristen
Meinzer,
even Lady Gaga shows up in this one.
Everybody's in this movie. Cuba Gooding Jr., Michelle Rodriguez, Jessica Alba, star-packed. And I have to agree with Rafer, it is stickier than the first one, but I see that as a good thing. This was a lot more fun than the first one. It's a lot wackier. The violence is cartoonish, but in the most enjoyable, entertaining way. I really liked this movie a lot.
Well, I'm impressed, Kristen, because usually you don't like it when the blood flies, so I guess this one's different for you, huh?
Oh, when it's fun blood, I can take it.
Kristen Meinzer and Rafer Guzman, our Movie Date team. Reminder, you can download the Movie Date podcast, which this week has Kristen's interview with the real Captain Richard Phillips. And stay tuned, because coming up next, Chief Mate Shane Murphy of the Maersk, Alabama, the real live first mate, about a side of the story that you might not have seen in the movie. Stay tuned for that. Well, as we just heard there from Kristen and Rafer, of course, Captain Phillips is this week's big release, telling the story of how Captain Richard Phillips commanded the Maersk, Alabama in 2009 until it was invaded by armed Somali pirates. You can catch an interview with the real-life Captain Phillips on this week's Movie Date podcast, but we're joined now by Captain Shane Murphy. He used to be Chief Mate Shane Murphy on the Maersk, Alabama. He was forced to take over as master of the ship when Captain Phillips was kidnapped. And I asked him about his take on the silver screen depiction of real life events.
Well, I think they did a good job. The whole thing is kind of surreal. They used the identical ship
to the one I was on to film the movie. So for me, kind of reliving it visually through the eyes of the camera was kind of surreal. And then to see someone portray me was a little off. But overall, I think, Michael Chernus does a good job.
Well, Hollywood taking liberties with the stories that they depict, you know, is almost a cliche. Of course they do. They take a lot of dramatic liberties. I mean, your situation was really dramatic enough on its own.
Yeah, I remember 4 years ago when it was happening, as I was, running through the tunnels and crawling around trying not to get caught, that this reminded me of, some of the movies I watched growing up, some of the great action movies in America. And I'm thinking to myself, this is very similar to this. Hopefully it all turns out well, and maybe someone will make a movie of it.
Well, let's talk about some of the real-life people that are depicted in the movie. First, the antagonist, the Somali pirates. You know, some of the critics have said about this movie that the four pirates who take over the Maersk Alabama are depicted unfairly or inaccurately, either too sympathetically or too monstrously or even in a racist way. You met them in real life, and then you saw the film. So where do you come down on this?
Yeah, I did meet the actors, and also I was one of – the only people to see and photograph the actual pirates that boarded the Maersk Alabama. So I had a good reference for who they were, and who they were trying to portray. And they did an awesome job. It was exactly what I'd hoped for. They put out an open casting call, and there's a large Somalian population in Minnesota, and these guys answered the call, and they were able to steal the show, as far as I'm concerned, with their acting ability.
And you were okay with the fact that the pirates in this movie are depicted with some sympathy as driven to desperation, really, by economic pressures and other pressures, not absolved of responsibility, but certainly there's some sympathy there.
Absolutely. That's always been a big issue with me, because ever since this story got in the news, and I obviously read a lot about it, and I thought that if done incorrectly, this could easily turn into a sort of a black versus white thing. And as you said, it's a financial conflict, really, not anything to do with race. I'm just glad all sides of it were portrayed well.
Well, Shane Murphy, Captain Murphy, what's life been like since the incident? It had to have been traumatic. You're obviously a captain now, so you're still sailing. I don't have to ask you about that. How's it been for you trying to recover from a violent confrontation like this?
It's been a struggle every day, but things are getting better. I have children, Dylan, Sadie, and Jason. They help me every day. And I've got a good woman in my life, Nikki, that has gotten me on the road to recovery here. And I think going back to work and going to sea helps, so I can stay busy. But there's days that it all comes back. And, when I see other violent crimes, gun-related crimes in the U.S., and I see the victims, I kind of always reach out to them or sympathize with them. I just remember the shock of it all when, it was about this time of day, and drinking coffee, talking to Captain Phillips, like I did every morning. And then, 20 minutes later, being barricaded behind a door with people shooting on the other side of the door and wondering if you're never going to see your family and friends again. Just the shock of that, and then having to kind of soldier on through it and get everybody home and call for help, that kind of thing.
All right. Well, Captain Shane Murphy, we appreciate you taking the time to share your experience with us. Captain Shane Murphy was chief mate on the Maersk Alabama in 2009 and was forced to take over the real ship after Captain Richard Phillips was captured by Somali pirates. Thank you so much.
All right. Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me on.
What we're doing is holding back a certain element of the aid, which we don't believe is relevant to the immediate needs of this government in terms of the roadmap or in terms of their security.
That's the voice of Secretary of State John Kerry announcing that the United States would freeze some of its aid to Egypt, including some Apache helicopters, tank parts, Harpoon missiles, warplanes, and about $260 million. U.S. leaders have still refrained from using that word coup to describe the military's takeover of the Egyptian government some months ago, back in July, a designation that would automatically prohibit American aid to Egypt under U.S. law. But the Obama administration's decision to freeze some of those assets is meant as a slap on the wrist, it seems, for the Egyptian leadership. The country has depended on American aid for 35 years, ever since Egypt signed the Camp David peace accords with Israel and the United States back in September of 1978. Israel is not pleased, and we're going to get into that with Ambassador Daniel Kurtzer, former U.S. ambassador to Egypt and Israel. He's now professor of Middle East policy studies at Princeton University. Ambassador, hello.
Hello, Todd.
Well, I just listed some of the things that are being withheld: weapons, Apache helicopters, Harpoon missiles, and that $260 million. Only a fraction of what we send to Egypt. I mean, really a slap on the wrist, right?
Well, I don't think it's a slap on the wrist. I think it's a shot in our own foot. We've had a strategic relationship with this country for 35 years. It's accomplished a great deal for us in terms of cementing the peace process with Israel and trying to expand it in the rest of the Arab world. In terms of intelligence, military, and diplomatic cooperation, we have always paid the price of this aid in tolerating dictatorial authoritarian governance in Egypt during the period of Hosni Mubarak. So why we're doing this now at a time of great turmoil in the Middle East, frankly, makes no sense.
But hasn't there been some political pressure, moral pressure, I don't know what you call it, for the United States to acknowledge the fact that this is indeed a coup, even if we can't use that dirty word because it has legal implications? Hasn't there been pressure to respond to the fact that the military took over from an elected government in Egypt?
Well, there's no question that the revolution in Egypt has taken a number of twists and turns, which we don't support, including the fact that the democratically elected government of Mohamed Morsi was ousted by the military in July. But it is a revolution, and revolutions go through a number of very challenging stages. Recall our own revolution. It took more than 15 years until our constitutional form of government took hold, and we didn't solve a lot of our problems for decades. I'm not suggesting that we simply turn over and accept the human rights and humanitarian abuses that are underway in Egypt. I think we have a very significant dialogue with the Egyptian government. We have ways of expressing our concern without taking actions that can call into question this strategic relationship. That's the concern that I have.
It may call into question partially the strategic relationship, Ambassador Daniel Kurtzer. On the other hand, $260 million withheld, but more than a billion more still flowing. Pardon the analogy. It's not meant to demean anyone, but it sort of seems like docking part of somebody's allowance, but you can still, you know, do your thing. Or am I misreading it?
No, I don't think you're misreading. I think the administration is trying to find a comfort zone between those who want to see all of the aid cut off as a means of expressing our discontent with Egyptian policy, and those who argue that the cutoff of aid is not going to have any particular impact on Egypt's decision-making anyway. In fact, the amount of aid we provide, even if we provided all of it, is much less significant today in terms of Egypt's overall economy than it was 30 years ago. And on the other hand, Egypt is in an economic crisis since the revolution, which, you know, there will be an impact, but it's going to impact on ordinary people. The military, in fact, does not need the Apache helicopters and airplanes that we're stopping the delivery of. So it's a political move that really has very little impact and I think will exhibit very little leverage on Egyptian decision making.
There are many voices on this side of the equation, as you mentioned, that want aid cut off entirely to Egypt. What would be the consequence in your estimation, Ambassador Kurtzer, if the United States were to cut off all aid to Egypt, or at least military aid? Let's say that.
Well, I think the Egyptians are mature enough not to fall over the cliff. In other words, they're not going to disregard the peace treaty with Israel the day after we cut off aid, and they probably won't cut relations with us. But they will find alternative means of addressing their needs, including Arab states, Saudi Arabia and others that are unhappy with the U.S. decision. They will find means of distancing themselves from us on issues that are important to us. For example, giving our warships, including our nuclear-powered warships, precedence in moving through the Suez Canal. That will complicate our naval planning as we resupply our forces in the Gulf or involve logistics of supporting our troops east of Egypt. And there will be a fairly significant cutback in a number of relationships, including intelligence relationships that have proved to be very useful to us. So it's not going to be an immediate break of relations, but we will have lost a lot of very important assets that help our national security. And it's not going to impact, I believe, any of Egypt's decision-making with respect to the threat that it sees in the Muslim Brotherhood activities in that country.
It's fascinating that even when a powerful country like the United States withholds aid, there's always someone else to step into the breach and do the job that you were doing. Ambassador Kurtzer, let's talk about Israel before we let you go, because the Israelis aren't happy about this decision. There is no denying that the money that we send both to Israel and to Jordan and to Egypt for any of its other purposes does have a stabilizing effect. Israel wants to see that stabilizing effect of U.S. cash continue, and they're not happy.
Well, for sure, Todd, for two reasons. Number one, there is a long-term concern about the stability of the peace treaty. As I said, I don't think it's called into jeopardy as a result of this move. But over the long term, I think the Israelis are nervous. But more immediately, the Egyptian government, under this interim government backed by the military, has not only acted against the Muslim Brotherhood, but they have also been quite active in Sinai in pushing back against violent and terrorist elements. At a moment when Israel sees Egypt finally taking significant action against Islamist terrorists, the United States is, in a sense, punishing Egypt. And I think that makes the Israelis very worried.
An announcement from the U.S. government that we will withhold aid to Egypt, including weapons, tank parts, Harpoon missiles, and $260 million of the total aid package that goes from the U.S. to Egypt. Ambassador Daniel Kurtzer, former U.S. ambassador to Egypt and Israel and professor of Middle East policy studies at Princeton, thank you so much.
Thank you, Todd.
Well, amid all the bickering and finger-pointing in Washington, D.C. over the debt limit and the government shutdown, there is one man in the Capitol building who is speaking these days to a higher power. Listen.
Lord, when our federal shutdown delays payments of death benefits to the families of children dying on faraway battlefields, it's time for our lawmakers to say enough is enough.
That's Senate Chaplain Barry Black. He's a Seventh-day Adventist, the first African-American admiral in the United States Navy, the first African-American Senate chaplain. And each morning when the Senate gavels into session, Admiral Black has the opportunity to offer words to the Senate body. And lately, those words have become far more than generic prayers. They become something of a scolding for politicians and a conscience check, really, imploring them to put aside their petty differences and do what they know is right for their countrymen. I visited Admiral Black in his office yesterday. It's just a few feet from where I work in the Senate, just a few hours before the president signed a bill to resume paying government benefits for the families of fallen troops amid the shutdown.
We have reached a point where the time for talk is over. I spent 27 years in the Navy. I made scores of calls to next of kin to inform them that their brother, son, husband had been killed. I know the reaction of incomprehensible grief. I've seen people faint at the news, just straight away, unconscious. I've seen people begin to scream when they saw me and my companion at the door. I was the one who usually broke the news. So the idea that this federal shutdown would have the unintended negative consequence of delaying death benefits to these grieving families, that was more than a 27-year Navy veteran could take, and it was expressed in my prayer, hopefully, the fervency of my prayer, that indeed enough is enough.
You are famously a low-key guy around here. You come and go. You're not a flamboyant person at all, but people interpreted you as angry yesterday. It sounds like you were.
Well, No, I wasn't angry. I was righteously indignant. and there's a difference. Remember, there's a story in the New Testament where Jesus put some cords together as a rope and began to overturn the tables of the money changers and said, "My Father's house is to be called the house of prayer, but you have made it a den of thieves." That was righteous indignation. But there's a legitimate place for anger when there is righteous indignation directed toward people who are being hurt and who have no ability to defend themselves. It is my responsibility and the responsibility of anyone who is attempting to obey the command, love your neighbor as yourself, to become the voice of the voiceless. And that essentially was what I was attempting to do in my prayer.
But you also wrote in your autobiography, and you've spoken to me in the past about your childhood experience in Baltimore, in a rough neighborhood, a terrible neighborhood, with a mother who raised you right, who gave you nickels when you quoted the Bible correctly. Mm-hmm. I remember that. Mm-hmm. And quite apart from your experience as an admiral, it sort of struck me this week as you're getting a lot of attention for your prayers that some of it may come from that experience too. Shutdowns affect people who rely on the government for parts of their lives. You were one of those people. It's probably not as abstract to you as it is to a lot of people in this building.
Oh, you're right. In my book, From the Hood to the Hill, I talk about growing up on public assistance in a single-parent home. My mother had a fourth-grade education, the daughter of a South Carolina sharecropper. There were seven siblings, same dad, but he was rarely around. And it was toxic pathology. There were prostitutes on the corner. There were drug pushers. On the weekends, you could hear the staccato bark of gunfire. And had it not been for the money we received from public assistance, had it not been, quite frankly, for LBJ's Great Society programs that enabled us to get money for school, I don't know that my siblings and I would have been able to escape the airtight cycle of poverty and pathology we were in. So I know that government can make a difference. And when government is not functioning as it should, it's disappointing, and I know we can do better, and I know that we will.
Do you think that this current standoff is fundamentally different in your mind, or is it just another fight, even though it's a big one? Is this one different?
Well, I think it's different. We had something similar in 2011, but this time it's different because when you wait until the two-minute drill to try to get the touchdown, something can always happen. There can be mistakes, a fumble, and that kind of thing. And the stakes are so high that the fact that we are repeating something that happened so recently, I think that this is different. And I hope that we will, out of this, come up with a system where we don't have to deal with this year after year after year.
My last question for you, Admiral. The Bible famously has a metaphor or a story for every occasion. People are tempted all of the time to say compromise is the way out of this. On the other hand, sometimes, many times, somebody's right and somebody's wrong. Are you informed by compromise, or are you informed by people who are wrong recognizing the error of their ways and relenting?
Well, the biblical passage that comes to mind for me in this stalemate is one that Jesus made. He said, "Which of you about to build a building does not first sit down and count the costs, whether he or she is able to finish, lest not being able to finish, people will say he or she started to build but was unable to complete it." I think that that is the critical issue. What do we want for America? We talk about American exceptionalism. You know, what do we want for this nation? And have we counted the cost? If we've taken an oath to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, then our lawmakers are committed to ensure domestic tranquility. So that's what that's all about, and I think that if we count the costs, we will find a way to resolve this stalemate.
Admiral Barry Black, Chaplain of the United States Senate, thanks again for speaking to me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Todd. It was my pleasure being with you.
Some godly advice there for our politicians in Washington, and they could sure use it. Well, next week, we'll be taking a look at how America's relationship to faith is changing. According to the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life, more young people than ever before say they've departed from religion. One in four millennials are not affiliated with any religion, describing their religion as atheist or agnostic or nothing in particular. We'll explore what this means in our series, Young Nation Under God. And as always, we want your take. Do you associate with a particular religion? Are you atheist, agnostic, religious? Do you believe that faith is still a core value in America? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We're collecting your stories all next week. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.